Hi folks, welcome back to On Call with Insignia, where we go on call with leaders innovating the future of Southeast Asia's internet and digital economy, or as we like to call it, ASEAN innovation. I'm your host, Paolo Aquino. And in this episode, join us in the third installment of our 50-year anniversary summit recaps, where we feature fireside chats with thought leaders and founders across industries, sharing their insights in various sectors and trends shaping the future of ASEAN innovation. This third conversation features the digital finance opportunity in Southeast Asia, which, while having seen an inflection in terms of the number of fintech startups being funded in the region, still remains in day one, with 70% of the adult population in the region still either underbanked or unbanked. On the panel, we have Greg Krasnov, founder and CEO of Philippines' first and leading fully digital bank, Tonik; Huy Nghiêm, founder and CEO of Vietnam's leading wealth management and retail investment platform, FinHay; and Tianwei Liu, CEO and co-founder of B2B fintech infrastructure platform, XFirst, which was acquired by Fast Financial in 2019, and has since become the original fintech group FAS, where Tianwei is deputy CEO. This conversation was moderated by Tim Lee and took place on the 23rd of September 2022, and both the episode and transcript have been edited for brevity and clarity. Let's hop into the call.
We have four countries represented today. We've got Greg from Tonik representing the Philippines. We have Tianwei representing Singapore and Indonesia. And we have Huy representing Vietnam. They're going to introduce their companies in a minute, but like, let me start by having everyone stretch their legs a little bit and maybe ask a simple question. So, can everyone stand up if you have a bank account? Let me see. Who doesn't have a bank account? Why are you still sitting? No, okay. We are not representative of Southeast Asia, broadly. 70% underbanked or unbanked. Now, remain standing if you've ever opened up a bank account in a new country. And sit down if you haven't, but remain standing if you've ever opened up a bank account in a new country. We've had a few people sit down, but a lot of people have had this experience. Me personally, I just moved to Singapore in June from the Bay Area, and I went through the process of opening up a bank account. I had to go in person. There was paper and pen. And I was telling Tianwei, and what did you call me?
Unbanked.
He said, you're unbanked in Singapore. Funny to think about it that way, isn't it? But actually, this is the reality for many people. And it's not like they have a US credit card to pull out as a backup. They are truly unbanked. So let's start with this question. Greg, perhaps you can begin. After introducing yourself and Tonik, maybe you can tell us why it is that in the Philippines we have such a high proportion of people who are unbanked or underbanked.
Thanks, Tim. Hi, guys. I'm Greg. I represent Tonik. I'm the founder and CEO of Tonik. We're the first digital bank in the Philippines. We actually operate under a full bank license, rather unusually for neobanks around the world. We were the pilot of the digital bank license by the Central Bank of the Philippines. And that's why we're the first to market and the largest, et cetera. Why Philippines has population that is so unbanked? 70% of Filipinos don't have a bank account, period. 95% of the Filipinos are outside of the formal credit system, have never taken a loan from a financial institution. So effectively, you have only top 5% in the credit bureau, and banks keep lending to those that have credit history. And if you don't have credit history, good luck. Go borrow from your uncle, go borrow from your mom, whatever you want. So actually, that's what they end up doing, is borrowing from each other. Why is that the case? I think there are multiple factors at play. One factor at play is that the mass of the Filipino population perceives banks as being by the rich, for the rich. And that's actually a massive blocker to the adoption. Second one, of course, is branches. That to go into a bank branch and to deal with an antiquated onboarding process takes a few hours to sign all the papers. And, you know, if you're thinking that it's not for you and it's by the rich and for the rich, then you don't go. And you think, well, why do I need it? I'd rather continue borrowing from the uncle. So this is actually what we're here to change, and especially on the credit inclusion, because I think the credit inclusion is a fundamental thing for economic growth, fundamental thing for social mobility. I personally experienced credit inclusion early on in my life as a driver of my social mobility. I was a refugee in the US in my teenage years. So I'm really a big believer in that and think we're fulfilling a big social mission.
To just tell the audience a little bit your own background there, because you've worked and lived in many countries, and since you mentioned your refugee background, do you want to just say which countries you've come through
Yeah, so I was born in the Ukraine, then I lived in the US in my youth, then I moved to Europe and was living in the UK, in Poland. Singapore is now country number 8. Philippines, I suppose, is country number 9. So really have moved around a lot, and that really helps me with the international perspective on the neobanking.
Thanks, Greg. Now, Tianwei, you have a different model at PayFaz where you're getting people included financially through B2B, but also make sure to touch on the little example, as Greg was describing, of the stigma between to going into a bank, which you told me before, because I think there's a story there that I think everyone can understand through that lens.
Thank you, everyone. Hi, everyone. My name is Tianwei. I'm one of the co-founder and deputy CEO of FAST. So a bit of background on FAST, we are formed by the merger of two YC companies, XFIRST and PayFast, about 2 years ago. We're currently serving about 200,000 small and medium businesses, from a small warung in Indonesia to a Web3 startup with some advanced API in Singapore. We're currently the largest business financing platform for them. So maybe to relate directly to the question you're talking about, I think we're sharing a personal experience I had, because I do also work in a couple of different countries. Before this, my background was in engineering. I was an engineer working about 6 years in the Bay Area before coming back to start XFIRST and now in FAST. As a young grad engineer, you always thought about most of the things that we have in the world, you always think is related to technology and API. And getting to know Hendra, my co-founder, who's Indonesian, I actually started visiting with them a lot since 2019, and there was this personal experience that really struck me when I was actually, we are the tech guys providing the infrastructure for the small warungs that was, powering the end user to provide financial services to the unbanked or underbanked. But from the data, it really, curious me one time when I was just mapping it out, I realized some of these small warungs are very, very close to bank branches. Some of the bank branches, the most active agents are actually working around a small BRI bank or a BNI bank. There's actually a physical bank branch there. And then I was so curious one time, I was getting Hendra to take a motorbike down on a Gojek, drove me over there. We sat down on the roadside having satay. When I was asking him this question, he was like, just observe. And then over a 30-minute session, I realized that you realize the customers that's actually going on to these small warungs, getting their services, just observe their attire, how they actually dressed up. You start to understand that it's really beyond technology. The guy that's really blocking the unbanked is actually the security guard standing outside the bank because he can't enter in that kind of attire. He gets discriminated. He feels unsafe. He just don't feel at home actually walking to the bank branch, which is something really enlightened me, right? You have to think about the social dynamic of things when you're actually building out your product beyond technology, right? So this is the kind of stigma that we are still trying to solve these days through a lot of our agent banking across the entire Indonesia. Sometimes it's really beyond the tech, right? There's nothing that's not technologically advanced. The personal part of it, the human part of it, is a huge part that's at play here as well.
Now, these agents that FAST have, how do they help bring financial services to their customers? Can you describe a bit of that?
Sure. So a lot of this across our work for the past 5 years, we have onboarded almost about 200,000 small mom and pop stores. In Indonesia, we call them warungs, by giving them a mobile application to provide over-the-counter financial products and services such as bank transfer, paying for water bill, electricity bill, telco bill to their neighbors. So a lot of these customers of them are actually their neighbors who walk up to them to buy a cigarette, an FMCG product, a mineral water, Aquamina, and then they will also ask for financial services, right? And through them, they become an agent of change. A lot of our customers get access to e-commerce for the first time through this agent, right? Because they have no way to make payments for Tokopedia or Bukalapa, right? You also realize if you just spend some time near the agent, the Gojek driver that we say is a huge part of the change that we see for the last 5 years, you just observe where are they actually getting their Gojek credit top out? Where are they having their coffee? It's again around these small mom and pop stores that are the heart of the economy over there. These are their neighbor. These are where they have very comfortable time during their downtime, sitting under a large tree, enjoying a satay taichan, and just chatting with their friend. And that's where they get most of the services that they get today.
Thanks for painting that picture for us. Now, Hui, I've opened up a bank account in Singapore now, so okay. I'm good. But let's say I'm in Vietnam and I want to open a trading account. What's the process? Can you walk me through that after you introduce yourself and the company?
Sure, yeah. So my name is Hui. I'm a founder and CEO at FinHai. FinHai, we are an online investment platform that helps retail investors in Vietnam to trade different kind of asset classes in the country. So to answer to your questions, if you were in Vietnam 5 years ago, probably you need to go to bank branches and actually sit down and wait for the tellers to invite you to come over and start filling out the forms and wait for them to send you an internet banking account and wait for them for 2 weeks to receive your cards. But now you can do it online. You can get the card within a day. Some banks even have the card printer in their bank branches, and they can send via Grab to your hands within a day. And you can start using internet banking within 50 minutes, I would say. It's very fast. Same with trading account. 5 years ago, probably you need to go to the trading firms and start signing up for paperwork, waiting for them to open a custodian account for you up to 5 days, and then you can start trading. But now it can be done within 5 minutes with us. So things change a lot now here in Vietnam, and I couldn't believe it either. I returned to Vietnam in 2017 from Australia. That was a sort of eye-opening for me, yeah.
And I remember when we were looking at the market, you know, some of these traditional players, it took them many, many years, I think measured almost in decades, to get to something like 200,000 retail trading accounts. Yeah. How does it compare now? How have you been helping to open up that market?
So the capital market in Vietnam was born in 2000, so we are only 22 years old. And the top performer in the market got around 200,000 funded account, actually actively trade with them. So after 22 years. And at Finhai,
22 years.
22 years.
200,000 accounts.
Yeah, that's the top performer. But for the entire market, we have around like more than a million active traders. But at Finhai, so we achieved that number. So we are serving almost 600,000 funded account at the moment in the last 5 years. And having that market shares, and also it's all due to the online onboarding process, it become streamlined and easier for end clients to open up a trading accounts and mutual fund trading accounts. Unlike other, has been really slow in changing it from the traditional approach.
I see. And a lot of these 600,000, they are new to retail trading in any form. They're not stealing them or having to compete to get them from these established players, right?
It is. To me, I see the market shares in Vietnam can be expanded instead of being stealed from each other. So what it means is, so the entire market have 6.2 million trading account opens, but only around a million of them are active trading. And we have around 20 to 25 million TAM from Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City. And so what it means is there's still more than 10 million traders or people that can trade out there in the market. So why would we need to steal each other for like 6.2 million trading accounts? Out there, there's still more than 10 million that can open a trading account and start trading. So that's what I see from the potential of the Vietnam market.
It's pretty stunning. So single-digit penetration in terms of the total population that's available on retail trading accounts. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you guys about another important topic in digital finance, which is regulation. Now, Greg, you mentioned in your opening that you were the first to pioneer having a full bank license as a digital bank. Why was that important?
I've been in consumer lending in different places now for quite some time throughout my career, and kind of started and sold a bank before in consumer finance, etc. One thing that I've come to learn is that if you want to scale your loan book into the size that the market opportunity deserves, and it deserves loan book into billions. You know, Philippines, for example, $10 billion is today the size of unsecured consumer lending, $11 billion the size of secured consumer lending. That's it, less than 10% of banking assets. And it needs to grow to over $100 billion altogether. So you're talking about loan book in billions that you can build with very, very small market share. You cannot fund that through wholesale liabilities. You can only fund maybe a couple hundred million max. And actually, I had a prior experience in the Philippines as well, because I co-founded a digital lending company there. And sure enough, you know, I did that despite my best judgment, and we hit a constraint on getting wholesale funding. So fortunately, we sold that. But we came to the central bank and we said, guys, please give us access to deposits, because there's $300 billion of deposits in the banking system in the Philippines today, earning practically nothing, getting a horrible experience. So we really wanted a bank license to get access to that cheap and sizable funding pool to be able to scale our asset side. We were very lucky. I don't think we would have the same situation with a regulator in Indonesia or Vietnam. BSP in the Philippines is a very unique regulator that is very experimentally minded and very, very focused on financial inclusion. They were willing to take an experiment on us. And they said, okay, we like your experience, we like your pitch, we like your approach. We want to solve financial inclusion. We get the role of digital into that. But how about we give you a rural bank license, but we make you our sandbox. And we'll learn with you and from you. And then we'll create a digital bank license regulation. And then we'll convert you into the first formal one. And, you know, we said, wonderful, just like call us whatever you want. Just let us do the business that we want to do. So I think the role of the regulator is critical. And I'm very, very sad to see that, you know, in Indonesia, it's being solved by the OJK allowing people to take over existing banks. In Vietnam, for example, there are no banks to take over. And the regulator hasn't yet solved the digital bank regulatory framework. We'd love to be in both of those places, but right now cannot.
Wei, I know that you also acquired a license. Would you want to say a little bit of how your process going through that?
Sure, yeah. So for trading license in Vietnam is limited, so there's no more new issuance to be issued in the market. So we have only 74 active companies that are available in the market. So it means there's only 74 licenses. And we've gone through that acquisition. It took us around 6 months to complete it from A to Z. That was very, very, I would say, challenging and adventurous, because you know the company was established in 2006, so it's like 16 years, and there are a lot of accountings and things that in the past we couldn't see and couldn't sort of go through it, because all the people that established the company, they has gone back home to their country, and we don't even know who they are. So that was very challenging. So it's just took longer than we expected due to a number of reasons out there. But all I can say is that very, very adventurous and challenging. Finally, we got it done. And so now we are in the next stage where, you know, before running FinHay, we care about like 20, 30% compliance. But now the compliance take us up to easily 70% of our daily operations. It's moving into more of a compliance work on a daily basis now, yeah.
It definitely sounds painful. You didn't use that word, but I'll give you that. And it was done during like the depths of the pandemic as well, where it was difficult to meet with people in person. And of course, those relationships are important. Now, Greg, you talked about expanding this loan book and making loans available in a rising interest rates environment, as well as the challenges we've had in the pandemic. Can you talk about how you're mitigating risk and managing your business?
Well, when you expect a big macro disruption ahead, and I think all of us sitting in this room probably expect that, then as a consumer lender, what you try to do is lend into safer asset classes, right? Or as any money manager. So for us, it hasn't been any different from that. Our original plan was to lend unsecured consumer into that blue ocean, a rising middle class. Now, the challenge of that is that A, there's no credit system in the Philippines that covers those consumers. So you kind of have to build it from scratch. And that means it takes time. It's a very data-driven process where you build your own scorecards, you build your own alternative data sources, and build until you drive the cost of risk down. And another challenge is that these blue ocean, lower middle class customers are quite exposed in an inflationary environment. Their disposable incomes are at a risk of shrinking. And they're also exposed to a macro downturn, because a lot of these guys are in retail or F&B, et cetera, the sectors that are going to go first. So basically what we've had to do is reposition our asset side into safer stuff. So we launched this week, we launched actually the first digital mortgage product in the Philippines. And that's a larger ticket, safer product because it's secured. We're repositioning our cash loan. We're spinning out a cash loan into the prime segment, more kind of banked personal loan segment, because I fully expect banks to pull back on personal loans. So we're trying to find ways of playing safer on the asset side. And, you know, we have the fortune of having completely outperformed on our deposit projections. So my liabilities are now at $150 million without really trying very hard for the last year. So we're able to go after that larger ticket business with confidence that we can build the liabilities to do that. So I think you just, you know, have to be safer with your asset allocation strategy, like I'm sure all of you guys in this room are doing as well. So we're doing the same.
I know that both FinHay and Tonic raised money during the last year or two, and so has FAS. But Tianwei, you also went through a merger. I want the audience to hear a little bit about Xverse and the founding of that, and then why you decided to combine in this last period.
Yeah, we didn't predict the pandemic. So that happens. I think I posted recently in my LinkedIn post. We wanted to do this since 2019. Me and Hendra has been a business partner. We know each other since the YC days. And we're working very closely in the Indonesian expansion, right? Actually, all these things happened maybe pretty fine. You know, I was the first guy he reached out on the YC network when he came to Singapore to fundraise. And he was actually staying in my house when he was trying to close England insignia for fundraising. So it's like something really happened right there. And long story short, 2019, we were already thinking about this. And I think some of those things you guys are discussing from a licensing perspective is super relevant to us, right? I'm a Singaporean. I was born and raised here, spent time overseas. and trying to navigate Singapore, you know, we are talking about some of the most open economy here in this region itself. Licenses and stuff are extremely difficult to have. And Xplus, which is a company I originally founded, was very fortunate to have secured pretty much all the licenses needed from e-money, from payment gateway to even DPT in regulator side of things. I think everyone can say about, you know, regulators around the region need to be more innovative, and Singapore is probably already at the frontier of that. But having spent like the last 5 to 6 years working with them, I will fundamentally distill down the fact that we have to face the fact that the number one job of regulators is not innovation. It's financial stability, right? So they need to make sure that things are going to be okay, right? And that is their primary, most important job. And with that, it needs to be trust, right? So I think the pandemic makes that even more difficult these days. But the fact is, you need to have a proven track record of being able to be on the ground, serving the community and actually doing a good thing before they will even be willing to, you know, give you licenses. So that was the backdrop that we were even discussing in 2019, right? Hendra and I were saying that we are both trying to expand the business. I'm looking to go to Indonesia. They were expanding out. But the problem is going to happen where if you're not local enough, you have not enough presence, acquiring licenses are extremely difficult to navigate. So we saw a lot of synergy already, that the fact that our businesses have so much overlap and we need each other to expand a lot, right? So that becomes something, one of the key drivers why we decided to come together as a company, because together we can achieve a lot more, and licenses will allow us to basically have a fuller reach and give more services to our existing clients. But we did not predict the pandemic. That thing happened along the way. And in some sense, it's a blessing in disguise, right? One thing I do learn from the pandemic is that, you know, new relationships are super hard to make online. It's kind of impossible to really bond with someone digitally for the first time. You can talk to them for, I've met some people for the first time after 2 years. I'm very happy to do that. But I realized that, hey, it's like kind of a new experience, right? So that makes it even harder in the pandemic itself, where you're trying to deal with regulators, that you say that, hey, I want to try and apply a license online. It's going to be an uphill battle right there. I'm so glad that was one of the blessings that we had. We have local founders, have local presence. And Hendra handles the OJK, I handle MES. It's such a blessing in disguise. We will just continue doing it that way, right? But it's of course not without its challenges. You know, to do this for 2.5 years, we pretty much did the whole merger remotely, right? We have met up in isolation, in pocket of people in hotel rooms, but never in a big group environment. And that brings about new challenges. And we are glad that the team pulled together and got through so far.
Thank you for describing that. And certainly sounds challenging, but glad that you and Hendra are together. And now I have one final question. Now, Tianwei, as you were talking about merging the companies, I know that Xplus, you started many years ago with a mission to make payments much, much easier. And I thought we'd be remiss if we didn't touch on the ability now for technologies like the blockchain to see you fulfill that mission in a more powerful way. Can you talk a little bit about your initiatives there?
So we at Xplus, now at FAST, have the privilege to serve some of the cutting-edge technology company on the blockchain space for the last 3 to 4 years. So I think some of the exchanges and some of the Web3 companies that we are, you know, hearing big brand names like Gemini, Crypto.com, are pretty much using our infrastructure that we have laid over the years, and we are the ones serving them on-ramp or off-ramp. So I think since before the pandemic, there have been a lot of talks about Web3 and a push for that. And we were fortunate enough that we already worked very closely with some of these clients, and together we have pushed off a project called Straight X, which is basically our Web3 arms. They have been piloting stablecoin for Southeast Asia. So we are probably now one of the largest non-US dollars backed stablecoin in the world that's fully backed by e-money, our e-money, existing e-money license. And we're working very closely with regulators, MAS, to transit that into the new framework that they currently are working on. We see a lot of opportunity in that space, and, you know, and in some sense, it's tied up to the talk. It's still really day one here. Ultimately, I'm an engineer at heart, and I always tell people that we really need to look at where we should be applying this technology, and they must bring about real-world impact. My mom really don't really care how are you trying to transfer the money. She will never understand blockchain, and I have given up trying to explain it to her, right? All they need to know is, you know, the same like Tonic, when my mom and pop store is trying to transfer the fund, does it reach there as faster? Is it better? Is it cheaper, right? That's all they will need to understand. And I think that's what good technology is about, right? Down the road, and we're probably going to happen, is all these things will disappear behind the scene when it's actually working seamlessly, right? Because the services that we are providing are not going to change. Ultimately, people want better services that will help them in their day-to-day life. They don't really care about the tech that's powering it. And that's what we're trying to do behind the scenes here.